Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place on the face of the world at 1-877-876-5227 or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries the show, contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at thespiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows are available now on the station archives. You can read my own blog at http://howtheneocons.blogspot.com. And first, a development in the Ada Smith case in New York. An article appeared yesterday in the Times Union. Evidently, bashing office workers is not the senator's only bad habit. The article came with this cap: Smith faces probe on funds use. It's by James L. Odata, Capitol Bureau writer. Albany. Senator Ada Smith is under investigation for allegedly employing two non-show or semi-show staffers, one of whom received at least $25,000 from her member Iden Stash to run a basketball program in Queens, according to people familiar with the probe. The alleged misuse of public funds was to be presented to a grand jury as early as this week by lawyers for Albany County District Attorney David Soares, according to one of the sources. Smith said she was unaware of the probe but wasn't worried about it if it's based on allegations made by two former aides who complained previously about her employment of Jukin Dockery and Pat Timbrighty. "Do you think a minority member has the luxury of a no-show job?" asked Smith, Democrat from Queens. Smith has charges pending against her in a separate matter for allegedly throwing coffee in the face of an former staffer. However, Soares' office this week reduced the charge from assault, a misdemeanor, to harassment, a violation. The DA's office needed to prove substantial pain or physical injury to the former aide, Jennifer Jackson, and couldn't, said Smith's lawyer, James E. Long. Dockery, a special assistant to Smith, ran the Morningstar Winning Circle Youth Program in Southeast Queens. It received $15,000 in member item funds from Smith in 2003 and $10,000 the year before for youth basketball in the parks. The program was under Dockery's direction, she said, but he did not get paid from the member item dollars. The money was for uniforms, trophies, and referees, she said. Smith said she called for Dockery to leave the group after Senate Minority Leader David Patterson took control of the Democratic conference in January 2003. Patterson, she said, set down guidelines to use for member item funds. The $3 million in discretionary dollars cut up secretly by the Assembly and Senate leaders and the governor each year. The minority's guidelines say funds should not go to organizations in which members have a substantial connection, particularly if a relative is employed. Dockery is a close aide, Smith said, and one of her residences is listed in his name. However, Dockery, who works full-time for Smith, and Tubridy, a part-timer, rarely appeared to be on the job, according to two former Smith aides, Douglas Green, her district office manager in the fall of 2002, and Philip Wayne Malik, her chief of staff for three quarters of 2003. Green also alleged Smith used staffers for political campaign work on state time. The Joint Legislative Ethics Committee looked into Green's allegations in 2004. Its actions are secret. But Smith said the panel concluded the complaint was baseless. Green said the committee ruled his charges were outside its jurisdiction. "I never saw him," Malik said of Dockery. "She would make up his timesheet and sign his and her name to it." "Things can look funny," Smith said. Malik and Green, she said, had no interaction with Dockery because he reported to me. They didn't see him because he was doing things for me. He worked more than they did. She said Dockery and Tubridy attended meetings for her in her district. Green complained to Soares, whose investigators have followed up with a grand jury probe, according to sources. Samuel Spitzberg of SORA's Public Integrity Unit could not confirm or deny an inquiry. His unit is also trying to gather information for a broader look at member item usage in the legislature, according to a law enforcement source, and has run into roadblocks getting information from the Senate majority. Senate Majority Leader Joseph Bruno and Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver have also refused to honor the Times Union's repeated requests for information about member items under the Freedom of Information Act. The Senate has received only one subpoena this year regarding Bush, said Mark Hansen, a spokesman for Bruno. Silver said the Assembly had received no subpoenas. Malik also said Smith misused $95,000 a year from her member item allotment to an annual senior citizen retreat in the Friar Tuck Inn in Green Inn, busing people from Queens for a weekend of events. He said the trip was political, aimed at helping her win re-election. Smith said the weekend helped elderly people understand legislation and state programs important to them. The organization that most recently ran the retreat for Smith, Southern Queens Park Association, has disassociated itself from the senator, said William Nelson, executive director. Quote, she wanted to dictate where we went with the program, what bus companies to use, what inn to use, when the trip was, Nelson said, adding that working with Smith was so difficult the group returned unused member item money last year. What nonprofit would refuse grants? Unquote. Smith said the break was mutual and that Nelson's group was unsatisfactory and unreliable. And that is our ADA story for tonight. Now our thought for the week ahead. This show is called The Spiritual Politician to remind us that Jesus was very clear about bringing our spiritual relationship with each other into alignment with how we do things here on earth. Those instructions were very clear. Love one another. One thing we can be sure, he said, was this. When asked how we should worship, he gave us this short prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. It's only 69 words, but this tells us all we need to know about what we are to do here on earth. It is a reminder of how we are to live and what we need to do today to fulfill the work he left for us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. This is a formal greeting reminding us who we are addressing. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. When you return, we will have completed these tasks you have set for us on earth as it is in heaven. When you return, we will have made your way standard operating procedure here on earth. Give us this day our daily bread. Give us every day what we need to do your work. And forgive us our trespasses. When we falter in those tasks you have left for us, remember, we are only human. As we forgive those who trespass against us, we will forgive our brothers and sisters who are also of your flesh. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let our hearts and spirits not falter as we give ourselves to that work. Protect us as we do those tasks given into our trust. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Because we recognize you as the eternal master and friend, so may it be. Now, how does this encapsulate what we are to do? We are to live with each other here on earth, as he told us, right? What did he say about how we were to see each other? With love, as one flesh joined through him. He never said it would be easy, but he has given us 2,000 years to get it right. The name of this show is The Spiritual Politician. Now, what tool do we use here on earth to deal with each other? Government. What message are we sending out every day through government for which we are morally responsible? Think about that. So, you tell me, are we doing his will? What will he have to say of our stewardship when he returns? Will he return before that job is done? think about that as you listen to the news tonight. Now, many of you have seen the movie The Da Vinci Code. That book was fiction, but Mary Magdalene was a real woman. And our guest tonight is a member of a congregation that, according to their own traditions, has been following the lessons set out by Mary Magdalene for the last 2,000 years. The Sophian Fellowship, by that tradition, was founded during the lifetime of the first disciple and the wife of the Savior. Our guest is a member of the fellowship and pronounces the name Jesus as Jesus, in accordance with their traditions and in the Essene way. Penelope Amidali found the fellowship after a lifetime of looking for the lessons her heart told her she needed to learn. And those ways and wisdom have become her home. Tonight, she's welcoming us into that home for a visit. Penelope, welcome to our show.
Greetings. I'm happy to be here.
It's so great to have you, and it's so wonderful to have found you and the foundation.
Thank you.
And we always begin by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. So, Penelope, where were you born?
I was born here in California in Glendale when it was this lovely, lovely area with trolley cars and no smog.
Ah. And you had parents?
I have.
Brothers, sisters?
There were six in our family and very long-lived parents. They were married 70 years before my father passed. And my mother, who is 96, is still very vital and very much alive.
How nice. And what sort of, what religion were you raised in?
I wasn't really raised in a religion. My mother felt that when we got old enough, we should choose our own. But in order for us to learn what she thought was Christian mythology, we went to a variety of churches that people we knew went to, and we'd go along as guests of their kids.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't raised to be particularly, in a particular religion or to look at religion as something you simply followed that your parents had followed.
No.
You were encouraged to actually do some thinking about it.
Yes. Yes, for some reason, my mother, who's first-generation Italian, when she came to California with my dad, left the Catholic Church and never set foot in one again.
Interesting, but you don't know why.
No, she never told me.
Interesting. And then your life continued. You had children?
I had a son and a daughter. My son is 45, and my daughter died in a car accident when she was 11.
Mm-hmm. But how long have you been looking, you know, for something else in your life? Was that something you became conscious of pretty early?
When I was 10, I can remember being in Sunday school at this one church we went quite often. And the teachings just never made sense to me. It always seemed weird that these people that didn't seem very nice demanded that but they all had to tell God how great he was. And so it made me think that their God really was more like a person than
mm-hmm.
God. And then when I asked some question, which I don't remember what, and got the answer that we're not allowed to question, that we just had faith, that just made, I was like, that is not right. And
mm-hmm.
so my 10-year-old mind started saying, I got to find the God that I know is there. And so that journey started when I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the Sophia Fellowship without realizing I found it 40 years later.
How did that happen?
I bought a home in what's called a target area in Sacramento, which meant it was so violent that they wanted people to buy homes and actually live there, so you got some special stuff in there, and homes were very cheap. And when I fell in love with the place and the home I decided to buy, in my meditation, I asked, what do I need to do to protect my home? Because I knew it wasn't, you know, what would happen in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the message to have it blessed, some sort of ceremony. And so I talked to a woman I knew who had a metaphysical store, if she knew anybody that did that. And she gave me the card of the person who I come to know now as Malachi.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Malachi.
Malachi is my Tao, which is the name of our master teacher in our tradition, our spiritual guide. And he is, are the circles that I study with, is his expression of the lineage that was passed to him through his Tao, and who he met when he was 8, and his Tao was about 70.
Mm-hmm.
And his Tao received his guidance to begin his circle from his Tao, who was a woman from France. So his Tao was from Britain, and so we kind of can trace back, you know, individual Taos, maybe 150 or so years, but the teachings say that the original message came from Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm. And so your tradition is that from teacher to teacher to teacher, the tradition and the words of Mary Magdalene have come down for 2,000 years.
Well,
in small congregations, with people reaching out to each other.
And the Tao has the capacity to understand when a person's reached a specific spiritual level. And so that term Tao is not given to anybody that hasn't reached a level of spiritual maturity and a, you might say, a linking with what we call the presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can be proper guides. They have to have walked on the path before us so they can understand the stages we go through and help us understand it and help straighten things, because sometimes they get a little weird when
mm-hmm.
the energy starts moving.
So could you give us the spelling of the word that you're using, Tao?
Tao is the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's T-A-U is how we spell it.
Okay, so a master teacher is a Tao.
Right, and so it's a symbol of completion, which doesn't mean they're perfect, but they've completed that level.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, at least our Tao is just the most gentle, loving, and can be extremely, he can do what we call musar, where if we really, really are totally staying blind when we have it obviously before us what needs to be done, he can talk rather harshly to remind us, but it's always in a loving way.
Mm-hmm.
So he is our guide. But he doesn't dictate to us what we need to do. He just
mm-hmm.
guides and keeps an eye to make sure we don't go off in wrong directions that will harm us and slow down our spiritual growth.
And I understand that you don't really have a theology as most of us think of it.
No, we have teachings. And the teachings are intended for contemplation, so understandings can be gained through that contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
And with the objective of gaining an experience, a body experience of what that meant, or a spiritual experience of what that meant. So
mm-hmm.
it's actually ours. It's not an idea concept that we say, oh, yes, we accept this and we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're always sort of in a place of process.
Always. And if ever we think that the teaching is the thing, the teaching will change and give a totally opposite view.
Mm-hmm.
So it requires us to stay fluid and to allow ourselves to finally discover what's meant underneath all the words.
What was it like for you coming into the fellowship and starting to, you know, to learn in a way that is so very different than most of us see religion?
That's an interesting question, because I've never thought of it. I have always been curious, and I've always loved mystery, and I've always loved imagination. So the way we learn seems to feed something in me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this exciting exploration, and sometimes it gets really, really hard, but and sometimes it's hard to believe that something's going to come of it.
Mm-hmm.
All I can say is it's much more satisfying. And there's always a sense of truth underneath it, even if I can't say why I have that sense.
Mm-hmm. So you remain in process all the time.
Yes.
But what it does is it centers you on a lack of a need to be tied to something, you know, a belief system that's really of the earth. I mean, the belief system really is a process.
Yes. And what it's taught me over the years, because I've been with them for 13 years, is how to more and more stay in touch with this. It's almost like the knowledge is in the heart and then it goes to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And trust and to be patient, which were very, very difficult at first, because I wanted something tangible. And so I've learned how to enjoy the tangible when it comes and wait for the next thing that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. And is that the experience of most people who are in the fellowship, that they learn to be in the process?
If we can't learn to be in the process, then it gets to be a very, very painful thing, because you're always trying to catch on something that doesn't have anything to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as saying, oh, this is it. And so people that, it's not everybody, our tradition is not for everybody, and we understand that. We don't proselytize. We understand that when people are ready, we are found.
Mm-hmm. Yes, when the student is ready, the teacher appears.
Right.
And Mary Magdalene, of course, is the focus of your work.
Well, she to us is the embodiment of Sophia, or wisdom. And in our tradition, we see the Christ spirit, the full manifestation of the Christ spirit, being presented in Yeshua as the male embodiment of it, and Magdalene as the female. So we see them co-equal.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason her teachings were not made public at the time is because the society would not accept that. And she was well aware of that, so that wasn't a problem with her, according to our teaching.
How much tradition about Mary Magdalene exists in the fellowship, in the memories?
Our website has a gospel that is attributed to her, a full gospel, that was orally passed on, because this is the first generation of Tao that our tradition is written. Malachi has written four books to kind of put into place what this tradition means. But before that, it was always passed orally from teacher to student, teacher to student.
Mm-hmm. And that actually goes very much along with the Essene Mystery School. That's the way they did it.
Yeah,
it was always oral.
Okay, yeah, we don't talk much about the other sects, so I don't have much information through our tradition on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that one of the reasons it had to go oral, I mean, originally not everybody could read and write, but then when the hundreds of years of the Inquisition happened, that was the only safe way. You couldn't put anything to writing because it could be a death sentence if it was found by any of the church.
Do you know anything about the fellowship's history that way?
Or we don't discuss it that much, but I do know that it's been said that many of the very, like the Taos that led circles in secret mystery schools, were also very active in the church. And part of, so they were kind of like in both places, so that when someone within the church, they suspected, began to have this mystical bent, this searching for something else, they would little by little connect with them, you know, go and talk with them, go and invite them to meals, and maybe after a year or two of this type of interaction, might more and more begin to see if they were interested.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big choice to decide to do that, and they did not expose anything to somebody that they weren't positive about.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about almost a lifelong process there, and you're talking about groups that were just within communities but invisible within communities.
Right, right. And, we consider that there's no end to it, that there's no goal but the path.
Mm-hmm.
We don't expect to achieve anything or get anything except become more and more who we truly are.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, you don't proselytize.
No.
You simply carry on the tradition and the teachings.
As a matter of fact, if somebody says they really want to join us and you know, that it turns out that they, you know, our whole approach is a little bit more intense, we encourage them to look at other traditions because there's so many wonderful ways out there that ours isn't the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And so we say that because we're what's considered a Gnostic tradition,
mm-hmm.
which was not a church per se, it was just means understanding and knowledge through experience,
mm-hmm.
which is gnosis, that experiential knowing. So if somebody just hasn't reached the point where they're ready for that, there's all these other groups that are available for that interim process. Maybe this incarnation, that isn't the purpose for them.
You say incarnation, so then you believe in reincarnation.
As a matter of fact, in our studies, that's essentially pointed to in the canonized Bible, the gospel that's canonized. Not even pointing to the ones that have been found since in the Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls and Pista Sophia, which was found in the 1600s. When Yeshua is asked if he's Elijah, that's pointing to they believe that these souls return.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they ask otherwise?
That's true. You must have been asked this question. Since the Da Vinci Code came out, has there been a pickup of people who are interested in the work that you do, if they can find you?
On our website and in we have a discussion site on Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
It is amazing the people that have begun, and they've been searching. And we say the bride just works in all these wondrous ways, and we think the Da Vinci Code is part of the bride's work,
mm-hmm.
with another term we use for Mary Magdalene or Sophia,
mm-hmm.
or divine wisdom.
So she's the bride.
She's the bride. Yes, and since Yeshua was a rabbi and an acknowledged rabbi, just from the Judaic tradition, he was married. You didn't become a rabbi unless you were married.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and to us, that was essential because how could all of humanity be uplifted through this incarnation and bringing in the Christ Spirit unless all of the expression of humanity was included, which means male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And the sexuality between them.
So that's something that your tradition celebrates. It doesn't view it the same way that traditional Christianity views it.
Okay, say your question again. Because
it doesn't view it the way traditional Christianity views it.
No.
Say the Catholic Church.
We don't believe Yeshua came in as God. We believe that this Christ Spirit entered into him after he became where he could receive it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was an extremely advanced soul when he came in.
Mm-hmm.
And then through the early parts of his life, it helped strengthen that so he could embody this intense energy, which would be the Christ Spirit. But most bodies can't handle that type
mm-hmm.
of spiritual energy.
What is your tradition about Christ? Was he born in a stable?
You know, he was born of woman. We know that in the Jewish tradition there were these they were called the there were sexual mysteries for husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that Joseph and Mary knew those mysteries, and when a man and a woman come together, doing that as their ceremonial spiritual practice, they truly become a representation of the Godhead in male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that respect, you could say that he wasn't born a man or woman because they would be like representations of spirits.
Mm-hmm.
But we believe he was born just like anybody else, and he was conceived like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
We see him as Elisha in a prior life, who was the disciple of Elijah.
Uh-huh.
And it was in the incarnation of Yeshua that that promise given of twice Elijah's power came into being. Because in the biblical account, all Elisha did in that lifetime was everything that Elijah did.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only in this incarnation as Yeshua that this twice the power came into being. So we see that Yeshua is the promise of Elijah. And we also see John the Baptist is the soul of Elijah. So the
How is that possible that you see the two of them as the same spirit?
We see that this consciousness, this life force that inanimates the body,
mm-hmm.
Enters in, experiences the incarnation, and at time of the body's death, it leaves. And the more that soul connects to an awareness of its true spiritual nature, the more it retains the memory and
mm-hmm.
is able to infuse it into the next incarnation.
So you have a continuity there.
A continuity in the evolution.
And what do you know about how Jesus, as you know, I would call him, Yahshua, as you would call him,
mm-hmm.
and Mary Magdalene came together and married?
We have this delightful legend. Malachi put some of the legends of Mary Magdalene into a book, and they were the ones that most reflect contemplations that essentially point to the experience of almost every person,
mm-hmm.
of being caught in the hells and then having that potential of that original true spirit be awakened again. And but in this one, it's a story of this prophet who in his contemplations in a cave is drawn up into the one who sits on the throne, and the throne, from the heart of that one who's on the throne, a light comes forth and a soul is formed, one soul. And it, as it comes into the lower, you know, the more dense energetic fields, it splits into two souls.
Mm-hmm.
And so the soul of Magdalene and the soul of Yeshua are actually one soul, expressed in masculine and feminine form.
Hmm.
So if you talk about one, you're talking about the other. There's no difference.
So they were two halves of one whole.
Right.
I mean, actual in spiritual and physical fact.
Right. And so in that sense, that is truly what we see as your soul, what is it, soulmate?
Mm-hmm.
It's when you when that soul came together as one and reunited in the physical, it created enormous shifts in the spiritual energy affecting this world.
Mm-hmm. What practices, what is your practice like when you're contemplating these things? Is there a tremendous amount of prayer and meditation?
It's different for every person because each person is unique in how they interact with the world and what draws their delight from them.
Mm-hmm.
So some people, who we call our scholars, love the deep intellectual probing and going through this text and that and contemplating them deeply, and there's all kinds of practices to, you know, guide how to do this. And others are more of a devotion, so they read it, and then they just contemplate it to feel the love that flows from it, to see what teachings that talk about love. There are ones that see how this thing can be incorporated into work. So each person, however they walk in the world, there's a practice that's suitable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's uniquely theirs. And we practice daily. And we call it practice so that we don't get serious and think that we're actually doing something. This is just a practice to keep us in remembrance of our true being.
Mm-hmm.
And so for each companion, who we call each other, you would talk to, probably there'd be a different answer to that question.
So you could, each person really is absolutely unique.
Yes.
Their practice can be anything that they need it to be, anything that it calls to them.
Yes.
And there is, I would say, an incredible wealth of history and tradition here that they can draw on.
Right. And we do have practices that are set to kind of guide a beginner.
Mm-hmm.
But the
tell us about those.
Well, one that we all start with is called the silent witness. And it's learning how to observe oneself without any judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody starts with that. And maybe it's just 5 minutes. And people who can't sit still, they're giving a walking meditation to do it while they're walking. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't, you don't have to sit still and do it. Another one is a heart meditation, where, you know, one quiets and with the breath, you know, bring that body into quiet and into the moment, and then bring their attention into the heart area.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine that there's this sun that's uniquely theirs within and behind the heart, so it's not actually the heart organ,
mm-hmm.
but it's there. And then see the breath flowing in and out through that center. And as the breath flows, this light gets larger and larger. And it's a way of beginning to see this light making everything within them like the light.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can be used later on for healing, for what we call giving and receiving, where when we breathe in a difficulty, either within ourselves or from somebody close to us, and when we breathe, and then it gets transmuted in that light. And then when we breathe out this light, this healing energy, and replace. So there's this cycle of giving and receiving until the, you know, we can do it with an imagining the person in front of us or imagining ourselves in front of us until both beings are this light.
Mm-hmm.
So it's light giving unto light.
That's actually very similar to some Taoist practice.
Well, one of the things we did quite a few years ago, because many of us that were in the circle at that time were recovering Christians or recovering Catholics, you might say.
Recovering.
Because of, you know, very harmful and difficult experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, since Malachi was exposed to all kinds of other traditions by his past.
Mm-hmm.
And so he studied with Sufi master, with a Native American shaman, with a Tibetan lama, with a Hindu teacher, and so he's pretty, he doesn't have, you know, he couldn't give you full talks and discourses on those traditions, but he's knowledgeable in. And so we studied the Vajrayana Buddhism of Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
And we did find that they're giving and that they have a thing called giving and receiving too when it's translated into English. And it is very, very similar.
Mm-hmm. So all traditions are open and welcome?
We see.
So it's sort of a very involving and encompassing, from what
yes,
you say.
We do not see Yeshua as this one and only expression. We see that the seed of the Messiah is in every individual, and that's what Yeshua is demonstrating.
Mm-hmm.
This is you. But we see also that Buddha brought in what we call the Christ Spirit. In Buddhism, it's called the Buddha Spirit. So we see this as not something unique to Yeshua, but we see that he brought a higher gradation of it because he essentially brought in this ability to transmute himself, which was demonstrated in the resurrection,
mm-hmm.
and still walk in the world, which he was, there might be other masters that did that, but he's the first one that did it with such a shift in the spiritual energy interacting with the earth, this,
mm-hmm.
according to our tradition.
Tell us about your tradition about the crucifixion. Is there a tradition about the Last Supper and that week
yes.
before the Passion Week?
Yes, to us, Yeshua knew what was happening to us when he was, you know, in the night of passion, when he sweat his blood,
mm-hmm.
that was the human part of him that was so fearful of this torture that he was going to experience. He was well aware of it because physically, it's been seen that people fearing extreme torture, actually their pores open and they do sweat blood.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew this was what was needed as a way of demonstrating where people could actually, it'd be so amazing, you couldn't ignore it, that this body was a temporary vessel.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the true person. And so to demonstrate this so graphically and then return is a way of imprinting that this was so.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see the crucifixion as the reason he came into the world.
So that it wasn't just your tradition is it wasn't just an accident that happened to him,
no.
It was what was pre-planned.
It was pre-planned, and all of the people that were there with him were part of the matrix that drew in sufficient of this spiritual force where this could all come to be.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Magdalene was part of that.
Yes, as a matter of fact, her early life in one of our traditions where, you know, she her caravan when she went to be betrothed was attacked and all the women were raped and she was sold into slavery, and because of her beauty they turned her into a prostitute. To us, that's the time where she went into the hells.
Mm-hmm.
And then when her remembrance of these dreams she used to have, and because she was very, very adept spiritually, according to our legends, as a child.
Mm-hmm.
But because she was a girl, it was, you know, told you can't do that, and it was denied.
Mm-hmm.
When she became an adult, at the time where Yeshua was baptized,
mm-hmm.
and the dove entered into him to us, that was the Holy Spirit entering into him, and that's when that seed of the Messiah was actually embodied in his body.
Mm-hmm.
She was met either by a holy man or the angel of John the Baptist. There's all these different stories about what might be, and was told it was time to return to the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm. Where was she then?
She was in Babylon.
She's in Babylon.
Because that, according to our tradition, was where the wealthy Jewish merchant she was betrothed to lived.
Mm-hmm.
At the time Yeshua went in for the temptation to us, Magdalene was experiencing the same thing as she recrossed the desert to return to the Holy Land to
mm-hmm.
search for this teacher that she was told she was to find.
And the teacher, of course, was Yeshua.
Yes.
Who then she then married.
He essentially, when he saw her, he knew she was, according to our legends, that she was the one. And he instructed his disciples, two of them, to take her to the river, baptize her. He met her. He spent a period of time teaching her what he's been teaching the other disciples,
mm-hmm.
and then returned and instructed the disciples to prepare for a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And and when he removed the demons from her,
mm-hmm.
the tradition says that because of the life she had to live, she did connect with these evil forces, but they were in her, and when they were removed, they were purified. And through, you know, there were seven,
mm-hmm.
and we have seven centers, we call them star centers, in the east they're called chakras.
Yes.
And so it was an indication that each center within her body was totally pure as a result of this act that Yeshua did.
So it's almost like a restoration of virginity.
Yes. And the interesting thing, I was reading something, and the word virgin originally meant one who possesses oneself.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Very.
So that's how a woman could be a virgin even though she was in marriage, because she still possessed herself.
Mm-hmm. which of course is one of the things that traditional Christianity took away from women. They didn't own themselves. They didn't possess themselves.
Well, I think they kind of took over what the society did at that time, because even in the Jewish tradition, the other traditions, no woman at that time owned themselves. They were always the possession of their father or their husband.
Right.
So it was a continuation of you know, what was done at that time. And we just haven't been smart enough to realize, oh, it's time to end this.
Mm-hmm. So they were married simply like that. She was baptized.
Mm-hmm.
She had some instruction, and then they came together as a couple.
Well, according to our tradition, they had a wonderful wedding that had good wine and lots of music and dancing and celebration, and then, you know, in that Jewish tradition, they had a tent, the wedding tent.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, while everybody else was just still having a wonderful time, they went into the wedding tent. And I just love this part of it, because when they joined, of course you don't talk about that, but fire and light just entered and filled the world, and in those few hours, the entire world was at peace.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so cool.
That's a beautiful tradition.
Yes, it is.
Are there other... Were they both healers? Of course, we always understand Christ as being a healer. And he said that all of us would be able to heal, too.
As a matter of fact, at the time of the Pentecost, all of the disciples became healers as a result of that inflow of the energy. And yes, Magdalene, she did everything Yeshua could do. She could
mm-hmm.
raise from the dead, she could heal, because she was the soul that Yeshua was the soul of.
Mm-hmm. They were one soul together.
They were one soul. And when Yeshua was no longer the world, and in our tradition, he taught more years after his body was resurrected than he did before.
Mm-hmm.
And so he taught with the disciples during that time and really taught the mysteries and helped them be able to receive them. But not all of them had the same capacity for receiving.
Mm-hmm. We're all different.
We're all different, and some just didn't have that soul maturity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you see all these gradations of writings, because not all the disciples were exactly the same. But then when the fear that there was a child of this rabbi that they had crucified, and they again put out the thing to kill all the children within that 2-year age range,
uh-huh.
That's when Magdalene left that part of the world.
And
our
tradition is that
take
she
her
was
into southern France, into England, where the women of the mystical traditions there that in the Bible are called pagan, but they're definitely were very sophisticated, had foreseen her coming, and recognized her when she came,
mm-hmm.
and accepted her. And so she expanded what they already knew with the teachings that she expanded into the world.
And at that point, Jesus, Yesu himself, was no longer in the world?
No. And she had the opportunity to ascend with him, and she made the vow, according to our legends, that until the time that humanity reached its full potential of embodying their Christ spirit, she would return to the earth in every generation.
Mm-hmm.
But our tradition, you know, we love the stories, but it's not the historicity we're interested in at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we when we begin to focus on it too much, we turn our face towards what does this mean to us? It's a nice story. Okay, contemplate it. What does it mean to us?
So what you take a look for is the essence in it.
Yes.
Instead of becoming tied to the mythology of it.
Right, or saying this is absolutely so, because we have totally different legends than the ones of her going to Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
We have legends of her being Mary of Bethany.
Mm-hmm.
And the term Magdalene means tower of the flock, so it was a title, not where she came from.
Mm-hmm.
So if we begin to lock on to one thing, we'll get another legend that says, oh, well, what about this?
And there are all the legends are equally valid to you.
Yes. Yes.
So that you don't become tied in any sort of, you know, earthborn sense to,
right.
you know, what the history was, because what you're saying is simply doesn't matter. That she was the teacher that she was with
right.
Christ.
Right.
They had the mission that they had, and that they have been fulfilling their mission over the last 2,000 years.
Yes. And even if the story's not true, we feel it should have been, so I think it's a great story to have. And it gives wonderful, wonderful food for contemplating our role in this life.
Mm-hmm. So it's just a way to sort of build out any role that you that sort of resonates with your spirit at a particular time in your lives, too.
Yes. And what we learn, this is the difficult part of the journey in our tradition, is we need to have a conceptual idea to integrate something, you know, an insight that comes.
Mm-hmm.
But then, if we're ever going to be able to have a new insight, we have to shatter that conceptual idea
mm-hmm.
and totally let it go. And the beginning, that's the hardest part, because you kind of fall in love with the concept.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so it's like this life-death rebirth, because the insight would be a birth, the shattering is a death, the new insight is a rebirth, but there's always this kind of vacant time in between where it takes you have to do the practices. You have to, because it's like this life raft in the middle of the ocean, until the integration's done and the new insight and awareness.
But no matter what, the focus always remains on your own journey.
Yes.
So that while you're grateful for the journeys that they, you know, that they made and what they've given you, the gifts,
mm-hmm.
you remain focused on the real import of the gift.
Yes.
Which is what they gave to all of us.
Right.
Well, Penelope, thank you so much. This has been an amazing experience.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. I mean, I think we've all found a tremendous amount of wisdom in what you said. It's a very different practice than many Christians have, but there's so much depth there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Bye-bye.
And that's our show for today, Friday, June 16th, 2006. We all understand that finding ourselves is a process. Each of us comes to the discoveries that mark our own unique path in ways that can be unexpected. This spontaneous ordering of life makes us unique, necessarily aware of those around us, if we are alive to the lessons Jesus left for us to learn. And we need to be open to knowing. Really knowing helps each of us continue our own spiritual evolutionary process and become a better, stronger, and more spiritually alive individual. To accomplish that, we must be free. As each of us struggles to be free, we all appreciate help in understanding what we need to know. And being free, knowing ourselves, and accepting who we are is the point of life, isn't it? To be free is to own yourself. To own has several meanings. And one of these is actually to acknowledge, admitting your faults and becoming uniquely a better person. Life is process. And in this way, we're working to understand that government is a tool, at times complex, at times simple, but just a tool intended to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Remember to ask yourself today, is government the tool he meant for us to use to better love one another? On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It is up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. When we know, when we have the truth, we're armed to take action. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. May God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.